incredibly popular around the Bouleuterion, in particular, as she pitched in to help create enchantments for the war effort. Her friendly and engaging nature had enlivened the usually dreary and dull work of creating magical constructs or munitions. Rael, of course, had been here for more than a year now, running the wizard's mercantile. Her generosity and willingness to hunt down hard-to-find items through her growing web of contacts had brought relief and even joy to thousands of Vanadori. Indeed, Rael's wild ways had set the tone for Vanadori social life from its inception. To their company, Mytherian had added some additional grace and charm. Her well-bred Gilmoran manners and her stinging wit had made her instantly popular in the few weeks she'd been imprisoned in Vanador. She didn't even bring her maid, a young nun of the Trigine Order, with her on these excursions anymore. She walked comfortably through the streets without escort, and without fear of being accosted by brigands. Thanks to the crowded conditions and the sheer opportunity of the town, there were few practicing the footpad's trade. Considering the penalties involved, I didn't blame them. The three young women were socializing on their own. I would not have disturbed them, especially not in the wake of a conversation so grim, but they approached us, to my surprise. Gareth jumped up and offered them seats before I could stay him.
"Please, join us, ladies," he said enthusiastically. "At least for one cup," he added.
He'd gotten a lot more self-assured and far bolder since he'd come to Vanador. 2 years ago, he would have mumbled and stumbled in nearly any interaction with women, but Dara, and now Natia, had had an effect on the man. He was far more confident now.
"Surely you would not pass up a chance for a cup of wine with the spellmonger?"
"As he is my jailer, I don't have much choice, do I?"
Mytherian said as she slid into her seat.
"In which case, I insist,"
I agreed, helping Andra into her chair. Rael thumped down into her chair without assistance, or terribly much grace.
"Since you're buying," Rael agreed with a grin, "but not this horse piss. Mardine, bring us a bottle of that good beak of ours I sent you. What has you wizards conspiring in a corner?"
she asked boldly. "Matters of great military import," I answered, "but we were brought hither by the choosing. Finradl sent all those students he's been collecting out onto their assignments this morning. What errand brings you ladies out in the cold?"
"Boredom, mostly,"
Andra assured, as she delicately took a cup in her slender fingers.
"I'm awaiting new constructs to be delivered from the workshops for animation. I figured a few hours of recreation were in order. Rael was with me, so we picked up Mytherian. We heard that a new minstrel would be performing this afternoon."
"Would that be Master Janik?" I asked, curious if the bard had settled into Vanador, as we'd encouraged.
"The very man," Mytherian nodded. "My maid, who swears she was a Wilderlord's daughter, just raved about the possibility of listening to the man sing. Apparently his line is famous for their silver tongues."
"He must be a Rish," nodded Thinradl. "I met a few of his house back when Duke Lenguin came north for the summers. The Wilderlords fawned over them like they were demigods, and they did sing well, if you like that sort of thing. But the southerners found their tunes depressing and overly melodramatic compared to the refined entertainments of Phallus. After the novelty of the locals wore off, they went back to southern poets."
"The Rish supposedly held much sway in the Wilderlands in their day," agreed Gareth. "I've heard some of the Wilderlords mourning their loss. If this is the last one..."
"Perhaps," I nodded. "He's done great service to the realm," I added, "scouting the penumbra for our military since the invasion. When I asked him to name his reward, he merely wanted to play before an audience again. Considering the number of taverns in Vanador, I'd say he got his wish." We chatted gaily with the ladies for an hour, defeating the bottle of Bicavar and overcoming the remains of the Gilmoran Red until the minstrel appeared. Janik looked much better than he had in Cheerfend. Though he was a small man, he carried himself with the confidence of a cockerel as he greeted everyone from the door with a short, loud snatch of song that spanned 3 octaves. The minstrel knew how to make an entrance. He was wearing a fancy doublet of sky blue over a linen undershirt. The bright green mantle he wore over his shoulders was as gaudy as the mottled cloak he'd worn in the forest was dreary. A baggy cap
that matched his doublet included a long peacock feather. In his arms he cradled a lute, a bit heavier in form than the Riverlands style, and a heavy satchel hung at his hip from a broad leather baldric. He sang a delightful melody, one I assumed was traditional to begin the entertainment. A scion of Rhys is in the hall, gaiety and mirth forth to call. Heavy hearts flee, maidens' hearts quake, for the Rhys has much merry to make. There was a chorus of cheers from the gathering crowd. Janek made his way through the well-wishers, who encouraged him to take the minstrel's traditional place near the fire. He spread his cloak over the wooden chair placed there, and ascended it like a throne, the lute seeming oversized in his slender arms. He made a dozen jokes and called for a tall glass of mead while he tuned his instrument. He did not acknowledge any of us magi over in the corner when he arrived. I almost thought we'd escaped his notice. But then he started to play a ditty he claimed was new. It was called The Spellmonger's Sow, and in a brief few minutes of verse, I realized just why the Rhys were so valued by the Wilderlords. The song wasn't particularly flattering to me, as it introduced the character of an up-jumped, common but pretentious spellmonger with a wandering eye and his sweet but addled wife. Often bumbling, with his common origins shining through his pretense of power, each verse detailed an increasingly raunchy situation that earned an equally absurd response from the pretentious spellmonger. The wizard finally manages to get a spell right, quite by accident, and is presented a pregnant sow as his payment. That night, he gets drunk and mistakes the sow for his wife and, well, it got really funny from there, but not particularly flattering to me. By the time the song was done, even I was laughing as hard as I possibly could. Indeed, I don't remember ever laughing that hard at a mere comic song. But Janek's delivery and skillful use of accent and voices made us all struggle to be quiet to hear the next bit. From there, he launched into a ballad, which gave me some time to reflect on his opening number. I should have been furious at the treatment he gave me. After all, I was the Count of the Mage Lore, the spellmonger, and the satire was clearly aimed at me, while I was in the audience. But I took a few moments to review the song, objectively, while Janek sang of lovers in some hopelessly dark situation. While the story in the opening song didn't present me in a terribly good light, it also didn't do much more than poke some raunchy jibes at me. With a bit of introspection, I could see exactly the elements he'd invoked to tease me. My common origins, my use of power and my well-meaning nature, and a little bit of pomposity. While the part with the pig was a little rough, and the spellmonger's wife's depiction exaggerated her infirmity, it wasn't particularly mean-spirited. Even the pig came out looking good by the end of the song. In all, it was a perfectly ordinary ditty depicting normal village life in the Wilderlands, and a bit of raunchy bestiality implied. But I understood the subtle subtext instantly. It was a challenge, to me, personally. Janek, scion of Rhys, may have been personally grateful to me for his rescue from the Soulless, but he didn't allow that gratitude to affect his professional opinion. From all I had heard of his line, the Rhys had acted as a kind of echo of the people's perspective through adept and entertaining use of melody, meter, and verse. If Janek's talent for satire was any indication, they were uncannily good at identifying the concerns of the people and presenting their findings to the nobility. The spellmonger and the sow was ribald and rude, but it wasn't the sort of thing that a population eager for revolution would produce. Indeed, the spellmonger in the song was a sympathetic character that seemed to do unexpectedly silly things that eventually turned out for the best. It was a cautious endorsement of my reign, as well as a challenge to me. The message was clear. We're all merry and loyal now, under the spellmonger's rule, but screw up, and the next song could be satirically devastating. As Janek took a moment to pause for applause, a drink and a few wry jokes after the ballad, he had the audience enwrapped, and it had grown. Vanador's Inns had no shortage of talented musicians plying its newly cobbled streets, but I'd never seen a crowd gather so quickly in one of the less populated quarters of the city. By the time Janek began his third song, the tavern was packed so thoroughly, I doubt I could have left without disturbing half the people in the room. The minstrel caught my eye for the barest moment before he began the third song. I recognized the expression, though he strove to conceal it. He was determining what mood I'd found myself in after the song. I gave him the slightest smile, and his gaze shifted elsewhere, but that moment communicated volumes. The Rish, it is said, watch over the Wilderlands, and I understood why. It had been scarcely a week since we'd plucked the man out of the bowels of the penumbra, and in that time he'd assessed the state of my rule upon his people. Not my people, his people. I just ruled here. For the Rish took ownership over the welfare of the Wilderfolk, that much was clear to me. And he treated the charge with such dedication that not even the icy stares of an insulted count and accomplished war mage would be sufficient to spare the ridicule of the Rish, if he deigned that I deserved it. Even if there was but one scion of Rish left in the world. Even if he owed that same man his life and liberty. It didn't matter who ruled over them, what banners flew overhead, or what dire consequences might erupt as a result of their satire. If a noble was unworthy of his leadership, the Rish would not hesitate to say so. The Rish were funny bastards, bards of uncommon wit. They saw it as their vocation to use that wit to protect the people from their own lords. I could appreciate that, I decided, as the fourth song began. It was another funny one, an old standard about the son of a smith and a miller's daughter, but he told it fresh and with a wickedly funny delivery. I found myself laughing almost as hard at that one, but I was still thinking about the spellmonger and the sow. I thought I'd made up my mind about the man, from the composition of the song and its intended message, when Janik went and surprised me with the final song of his set, The Road to Vanador. I was as startled. Only a few people knew that song, and I knew them all. It had been the song I'd crudely cobbled together on the way up the northern road, with my father banging away merrily on the travel instrument the god Crowther had gifted him. I'd only sung it a few times since, and had nearly forgotten it, after all the trouble of this last year. But Janik rendered it in a proper key, and though he'd taken some liberties with some of the verse, it was decidedly the same song. Only he sang it beautifully, while Dad, Brother Bright and I had brayed it out like donkeys. Indeed, I saw a few melted hearts and tearful faces as he finished up. There was far more meaning in the song than I'd ever intended to put there. "Bring the man to me," I instructed Gareth, as applause filled the tavern. He nodded and pushed his way politely through the crowd as Janik had his cup refilled with mead. In a moment he returned with the slender minstrel in tow, and graciously gave up his seat. "Well done, Rish," Thin Raddle said approvingly, still clapping. "I needed that after this morning." "It's not often I get to drink with a count," Janik said casually as he settled into the chair, and immediately grinned broadly at the three ladies at the table. "I'm sure you'll be gracious enough to pay the bill. And what a charming set of smiles you've brought with you," he added, just a little obsequiously as he flirted with the women. "What a drink of fine wine after the first years I've had on the road," he assured them charmingly. Then he raised his glass to me. "To the health of the Count," he called out, and everyone in the room drank after cheering my health. "Is this the last good drink I get before you have me hauled off to the dungeons?" he asked me slyly as the people toasted. "If it is, I'd like to top it off." "You'll not sup at my expense that way, Janik," I chuckled. I fingered one of my rings and invoked a hoxter. A small pile of silver towers appeared on the table. "Take the silver and spare the space for worse offenders." "I enjoyed the song," I assured him. "Then this is the part where you tell me never to dare such a thing in your presence again," he said, not touching the silver. "On the contrary," I said, pushing the coin over to him. "Not only am I not the sort of man to take offence, I'm a subtle enough wizard to realise the message implicit in the composition. I urge you to speak your mind freely when it comes to my rule." He studied me carefully, the eyes so recently engaged in gaiety suddenly deadly serious. "You'll realise what a dangerous dagger you've put in my hand?" he asked. "Are you a masochist, sire?" "I'm a count, facing a horrific foe in an unsettled land, leading a doughty people," I corrected. My ego is not to be bruised so easily. But I have one, I assured him, perhaps not as pompous in person as I appear in song, but I will attempt to live up to the high expectations of your verse. Janet gave me a genuine grin at that. Then you do realize the meaning of the song, he said, continuing to drink his mead.
I thought it was a bit rowdy, giggled Rael, but fantastic. Oh, Mindolin, don't you dare get upset by it, she urged.
I'm not upset, I insisted, and the song was more than jest, it was a test. Wasn't it, Janik? The minstrel shrugged his spare shoulders, an expression of pure innocence on his face. I yield to your insight and wisdom, my lord. If I finished the set and was clapped in irons, then it would be clear what kind of lord you were. If you warned me never to speak your name in verse, well, that would also tell me much about you. Indeed, I could draw a great number of conclusions from how you reacted to that bit of doggerel. And what conclusions have you drawn? Urged Thinradl, who was enjoying the conversation.
That Count Mindolin is a man of deep insight, with a thick skin, a good heart, and he is a fine judge of character, concluded Janik loudly.
Those around us cheered a little. I'd like to add a boundless capacity for forgiveness to the list, he added, shooting me a glance, and an uncommon generosity. Are those your observations, or reflections from the people? I asked. Can't it be both? He riposted. I am one of the people, after all, an entertainer, a mere commoner, as were you, once, he emphasized. But I'll not piss on your head and tell you it's storming, he continued. If you become a tyrant, you can expect harsh treatment from my instruments. That's a dangerous attitude for a minstrel to have, Master Rhys, noted Thinradl. Do you not fear the wrath of the spellmonger?
If he had, he never would have sung the song, argued Matherian.
In truth, I dodged the clutches of the Gavanni and their Dark Lords for 6 years, off and on, Janik reported over the rim of his glass. I fear nothing from humanity, compared to what lay waiting for me in the penumbra. There were dark things implied in his tone. His face wore a wooden expression. In truth, it is a more dangerous thing for a ruler to constrict the voice of the people, I proposed, especially mage lords. We are as prone to making mistakes as any man. If my people think I'm a well-meaning but pompous ass, I want to know that. If they see me a tyrant, that I'd know as well.
That's uncommonly generous from a common-born count, observed Janik.
I assure you, my lord, I will absolutely skewer you, should you earn it. I shall flay you with fragrant verse, demolish you with a jaunty tune, and grind you between my caustic wit and whatever metaphor is handy, he promised. He said it in a jovial tone, and everyone at the table smiled and laughed. But I could tell that behind his casual manner, he was deadly serious. He would spare me no criticism out of gratitude or an attempt to flatter me. I can also count the song successful on another count. I wager you'll never look at a pork pie quite the same way again.
Chapter 5 Of Kurds and Kings. Let us sing a hymn of praise to the goddess of the kine. Praise be the bearer of burdens, praise be the pure one, she who pulls the sacred plough, she who gives the blessed milk. The queen of the herds bestows on us the gifts of abundance and wisdom. Praise her in the springtide when the calves are sacrificed, praise her in the autumn when the bulls are culled. Life and death in the service of life, we praise Bova the blessed for her abundant benevolence. Moom, moom, moom. Hymn to Bova, Goddess of the Kine, from the collection of Janik the Rhys. Among the many other things I was doing that spring, preparing for war, practicing politics, plotting to save the world, I indulged my wife by building her a creamery. That might seem a wildly unimportant priority, considering all of the other burdens on my shoulders, but she had requested we build one when we had first come to survey the site for Spellgarden. Of course, she had also asked for a lake, but it seemed easier to build a creamery. It wasn't unimportant to me, however.
Not only do I like cheese, this creamery represented a possible means for Alia to ground herself in this world. My hope was that the sights and smells, the feelings and the familiar surroundings of a simple creamery would help reinforce the work that the handmaiden was doing in repairing her mind. She had been in a creamery since she was a little girl. Then she managed her family's enterprise in Beauval Vale. Alia might have been hopeless at needlework, but she knew how to make cheese. I spared no expense. I was lavish with both financial and arcane support. I'd consulted with as many people as possible before proceeding, and in truth, it only took a day or two out of my life to begin the process, and then inspect it as it was progressing. For those unfamiliar, making cheese is one of the Humani arts that the Alon don't seem to practice. In fact, some, especially among the Alka Alon, find the idea completely foreign and repugnant. Other Alon have no opinion, or enjoy the food for the unique Humani novelty that it is. Only the Tal Alon, among all the Alon, seem to delight in the consumption of cheese, and have even tried their hand at making it, once they saw the utility. Their particular variety was usually a semi-soft goat cheese, wrapped in cabbage leaves and fermented in the dark recesses of their burrows. The cabbage keeps the exterior moist, I'd learned, and propagated a particular kind of mould that the Tal favoured. As they are the only Alon with significant fat deposits, I assume it's because the protein-rich food encourages them to store energy in such a way. Gavani and Karshak seem indifferent to the idea as a rule. Cheese is the fermented product of curdled milk solids. You take fresh milk, either sheep, goat, llama, or cow, and keep it from spoiling by spoiling it on purpose. By adding a curdling agent, most of the milk solidifies. The protein in the milk binds together in a smooth clump. The rest of the milk is a translucent fluid called whey, which also has uses. But the curds are the important part. That's where the valuable protein and fat is found. Once the curds are strained from the whey, salted and pressed, they congealed into a solid or semi-solid mass. Then they start to ferment, giving cheese its distinctive odour and flavour. Once it sits around long enough, the moulds introduced to the curds transform the milk solids into a smooth, protein-rich foodstuff that can be preserved for months or even years. Actually, once I describe the process, I think I can see the Alon's point. If you are unfamiliar with cheese, then what it is, where it came from, and how it's made and aged does seem a little disgusting. The Alon, as a rule, don't domesticate many animals compared to humans. We emerged from the void with hundreds of species of animal cultivated for various uses, from faithful dogs and cows to the horses that bore our burdens and still carry us into battle. For good cheese made in the traditional Wilderlands manner, the preferred milk came from cows. And in our case, the herds that would provide the milk were just becoming established in the three smaller states around the domain over the winter, while a large corral was being built in Spellgarden. But there was a lot to be done before they could even begin grazing in the newly exposed meadows and start delivering milk. I knew little about the process, but I hired a dozen wilder folk who did, and as soon as the ground thawed, they began constructing the creamery, with my castellan's assistance. Master Speredek was intrigued by the project, though he had dozens of others underway around my castle. Like most arcane professionals, he understood the theory of such things, but he lacked any real experience. Mostly, he watched, and provided what spellwork he thought would improve the process. I checked in with him periodically to ensure everything was being done to Alia's specifications. It was a grand example of a creamery. The main cowshed was long and low, built a foot into the ground and constructed of stone to encourage a cool, damp environment. A drain was dug from the centre of the place, and at one end a room was carefully sealed against drafts and pests. It was lined with shelves of cedar to store the cheese once it had been formed. Two great earthenware vats were procured from the wizard's mercantile for use in turning milk into curds and whey. Long, dull copper knives and a supply of wire were secured to cut cheeses. Alia bought yards and yards of rough-woven cotton muslin and bleached linen for cheesecloth. She ordered new wooden moulds and a press to be constructed in Vanador. The perimeter of an entire pond was seeded with string grass, because cheesemaking apparently uses a lot of string, and a couple of casks of cider vinegar was ordered for cleaning. A great wagon load of sea salt was brought in from Rael's warehouses. Milkmaids were interviewed. Two Kasari lads were hired to whittle the many wooden implements necessary for the creamery. I monitored the construction from afar, allowing Alia the freedom to direct the project. With plenty of gentle assistance from her crew when she experienced episodes of distraction, I was gratified to see those become few and of less intensity when she was involved in the creamery. I reckoned it was the familiarity of the process that kept her engaged with her humanity. She had been making cheese since she was a little girl, and those deeper memories were strong. But, other than a few casual visits, I kept my distance and contented myself to watch. Alia was truly in charge, which was refreshing to see. The creamery allowed her to take some independent agency over herself, and to speak with an authority that had been absent since her injury. When she was confronted by one of her spells of madness, Speredek and the nuns, one of whom was always attending her, would quickly calm her down and, if needed, summon aid. The children frequently accompanied her, intrigued at seeing their mother actually do something other than sit and stare at the fire. The work went quickly, as projects with unlimited budgets and substantial magical support often do. Nor was it poorly constructed, for all the haste in its building. The utensils and crockery, moulds and cloths, were of exceptional quality, and the aging house was ideal, the cheese expert said, for the purpose of turning milk into cheese. Indeed, it was perhaps the most splendid and charming cheese shed ever built in the Wilderlands. The creamery's fenced-off compound was the one area where Alia felt in command of herself. She knew what she was doing here. That was untrue anywhere else, even in caring for her children. Actual production could not begin until the small but important ritual known as Bova's Sacrifice was conducted. I'd never really heard of it, as it is of interest primarily to those whose livelihood depends on dairy herds, and therefore a fundamentally rural practice. But cheesemaking in the Wilderlands was dependent upon it. All cheese comes from curdling milk, Alia explained to me as she proudly gave me a tour of the finished facility. The words spilled from her lips easily. That was a welcome change to the short answers she usually gave in conversation. I thrived, hearing her speak so easily and fluidly. The methods of curdling can vary, according to your resources, she continued. The very poor wilderfolk merely let their milk spoil and retrieve the curd after a few weeks. Some cheeses are made using the juice of nettles or lemonwort, which can be harvested and prepared in the wild. But the very best cheeses are made with rennet from the stomach of a new calf, she explained. That implies that the rancher has a large enough herd to justify slaying the weakest for that purpose, which implies that they are wealthy, or part of a wealthy manor, I suggested conversationally. Exactly, she nodded enthusiastically. Father's herds at Hawk's Reach were large enough that we had to slaughter two calves to provide that much rennet. The two weakest calves, she added, to strengthen the herds. The stomach lining, when properly dried, is the very best means of curdling milk. And there was always a big feast that night, after the butchering, a welcome break from the long winter diet of preserves. But the rennet is the important thing, she continued, as we walked through the muddy yard. You have to have good rennet. That turns the milk into curds and whey. Curds are the solids, whey the liquid, she told me, as if I was unaware. I didn't take offence. I was enjoying this. We use whey for baking bread, I nodded, recalling my father receiving crocks of the stuff from local peasants. It added a richness to the crumb that he liked for some recipes. The curd is essential, she assured me. You cut it with the knives, let it sit, then remove the remaining whey through straining and pressing. That's the short version. There are endless ways you can do it, though. That's a good bit of the art of cheesemaking. What's the other part? I asked, curious. The moulds and the aging, she supplied. All cheeses are fermented, but the flavour and the texture depend on which moulds are used and how long it's aged for, and the conditions. But it all starts with good fresh milk and good rennet. She led me through the compound hand in hand, pulling me to each building and explaining its role in the process. I silently used mage sight to examine the magical architecture that had been employed to, say, keep the ice house frozen, the aging shed cool and damp, and the creamery itself free from malicious spores and germs. That included a spell to keep the calves in the small byre attached to the complex from straying from their corral. "The sacrificial ceremony will be tonight, by the light of the full moon," Alia told me, as we petted the nose of the two calves chosen for the sacrifice. "We managed to scare up an authentic priestess of Bova from the Wilderlaw, Milk Sister Donza. She arrived yesterday."
"I've never met a Milk Sister before," I realized, amused.
"Me neither, I think," Alia admitted. "She's nice, very matronly," she decided. "She's already blessed these two calves and their mothers, and she's very impressed by the creamery," Alia said, pleased. "There are a lot of dairy herds in the Eastern Wilderlaw, apparently, but she says the milk from the highlands in spring is considered superior to all other milk for cheese making. She also brought me some culture mediums from down south," she bragged. "It will help with my experiments."
I was surprised.
"Experiments? What are you experimenting with?" She sighed. "I want to try to recreate Bovali cheese," she explained, "only that's impossible. The conditions and cultures in Boval Vale were unique."
"It was just another mountain vale," I said, confused. "Meadows, pastures, calves.
What made it so unique?"
"It was Boval Vale," she said, as if that explained everything.
"It was its own place," she said, fumbling for the words. "The vales to the north and to the south, they were their own places. They cannot be replicated. You could make cheese in exactly the same way in three different vales, and they could and will be different. I need to find the right cheese for this place. For Spellgarden," she said, glancing up at the tower. "That will take some time and experimentation."
"How will you know when it's the right cheese?" I asked, confused.
"It just will be," she assured. "You just know."
"I suppose it's a bit like magic," I decided. "A lot of the art in it comes from the subtle and intuitive. That's why each wizard leaves unique traces in their spellcraft. It tends to get mixed up in just about everything you do."
"I plan on using the first milk of spring to try the first batch," she said happily. "Then we can start the first trials." "I'm excited," she confessed.
"As am I, my love," I smiled in return.
"And cheese is useful stuff," I added, as if trying to lend legitimacy to the investment. "It's about the only way to preserve milk beyond a few days. Without magic," I added. "Some stasis spells could retard the spoilage of milk for at least a week or two, but it wasn't the sort of magic that was often indulged in." "Cheese is its own magic," she assured me. "The flavours, the textures. There's just something terribly human about them," she said, still struggling for words.
"I'm partial to it," I agreed, "and I look forward to tasting your efforts."
"Oh, the first cheeses will be awful," she predicted, "even with all of these magnificent supplies you have provided me. It will take time and effort to see what the best process is suited to this environment." "This is beautiful land," she said, gazing out over the pastures. "It will produce a beautiful cheese one day," she promised.
Yes, it was a bit silly. I was probing the secrets of the universe while defending my people from certain destruction, but indulging my wife in her passions was the most important thing in the world to me that moment.
"Tonight is the last waxing moon before equinox," I agreed, "and if anyone can find the right cheese for this country, you will, my love," I said confidently. We embraced. I felt a little silly. I didn't give a damn. Sometimes making your wife happy is more important than anything else.
After Bova's sacrifice and the resulting feast, Alia and I retired to our chamber late in the evening, tired from the late-night ceremony. Milk Sister Donza had been an imposing woman, but she was adept at her craft, and her sense of ceremony was admirable. I learned more about bovine husbandry and cheesemaking that night than I ever imagined. But I was awakened from a sound sleep by Ruderal, who had an urgent look on his face.
"Master," he whispered, as he shook my shoulder gently. "A runner came from the mirror array. You have a message. A summons to attend the king at your earliest possible convenience," he said,
a worried look on his face.
"Don't be anxious, boy,"
I soothed as I swung my legs over the bed. The king summons me from time to time for all sorts of reasons, even in the middle of the night. Fetch my second-best tunic and my best cloak, I ordered tiredly, and do it with mage sight. Don't wake up, Alia. Being summoned before the king for a private discussion is always unsettling, even if you're a founding member of the royal court. Perhaps especially if you're a founding member of the royal court. But when your monarch summons you, you go, by the most expedient means necessary. I came through to the royal palace at the waystone I'd set outside of the court wizard's offices, where my friend Loico met me, before escorting me to where His Majesty was waiting. "It's the bloody prince," he told me, not bothering to whisper in the night. "His vassals have some sand in their skirts about you and Astarol, and Tavard's gotten the king involved. A bunch of foolishness, if you ask me," he added crossly, "and word has come from Faris. Certainly not worthy of a midnight meeting." "What's Rard's disposition, if you don't mind me asking? It might be helpful to know what I was walking into," I decided. "He's about as annoyed about the situation as I am," Loico said, shaking his head. "He's far more concerned about Faris and Wensha than squabbling Gilmorans. Domestic disputes between his vassals are not where he wishes to place his royal attention." Rard met us in his solar, not the grand extravagant chamber where he met with dignitaries, but the smaller, cozier and darker room in which he did most of his actual work. He sat in the chair, which was his throne by virtue of him sitting in it, and patiently waited. "Majesty," I said, with a respectful but casual bow. He nodded in return. "Bide, Minolan, while my son fetches his vassals," Rard ordered, indicating a chair. I took it, and it remained a mere chair, even though my butt was using it. "Kings get all the good perks." "I've heard that you are at war," he said, as if making conversation. "Between wars, actually," I shrugged. "We defeated one army. Another prepares to strike. That's just life in the Mage Lawn." "That's more excitement than we've had," he admitted. "Here, everyone is gossiping about the opening of the new tournament season," he snorted. "Meanwhile, I have Faris in the hands of pirates and Merwin menacing Wensha, dragons in the sky and white lords raiding my subjects," he said, shaking his head sadly. "All the world seems to be unravelling, and here I am entertaining this," he scowled. "Might I ask what this matter might entail, Your Majesty, if it requires the head of the Arcane Orders?" I asked soothingly. "It doesn't," he admitted. "You are here in your capacity of Count of the Mage Law. One of my son's vassals says one of your men has kidnapped a woman. Well, one of Duke Anguin's men, but he's a mage lord. So that involves you." "Astarol," I realized. "Ishes, tits, was I being summoned to a midnight council with the king over this? My plan was working better than I anticipated." "The sorcerer's name is Astarol, Baron of Lasara," Prince Tavard declared as he entered the chamber, followed by four of his vassals. "Two counts, including Count Anvaram, and two barons. He's kidnapped the woman to whom he is engaged during dowry negotiations, and now he won't release her back to her family," Tavard reported. "Ah, Astarol," Rard said, nodding. "He is a baron now, isn't he? So he's kidnapped this woman?" the king asked, confused. "Most cruelly, Your Majesty," Anvaram agreed, his voice thick with exaggerated anguish. "By tricks and spells, he ensnared the guards placed around the maiden and then stole her away. We've searched the scoundrel's lands thoroughly, aye, and the lands of his kin, too, but she is nowhere to be found." "You suspect foul play?" Rard asked, surprised. "It's hard to know when we don't know what's come of her," said the count, sounding aggrieved. "It's as if she's vanished into the darkness. There's no telling what the sorcerer is making her endure." "Astarol would never harm a lady," I insisted. "Indeed, he had no desire nor intent to." "So, you are aware of this affair, Count Minolan?" Rard asked, frowning.
"I recall hearing something about it," I demurred. "I've been a little busy this winter, if you remember. Astarol was in negotiations with the maid's parents about the dowry. Things got heated, and he invoked some old Gilmoran custom," I dismissed.
but I don't see how this is a matter requiring the attention of the Crown or the Royal Court at this late hour.
I'm starting to wonder about that myself, Rad agreed, staring at the Gilmoran nobles.
This mage lord must be brought to justice, declared Anvarum. I demand that he is summoned before your majesty and be forced to answer for his crimes.
I think that would be fair, father, Tavard added, his arms folded across his chest.
Clearly he was enjoying the spectacle and my role in it. Kidnapping is a serious matter.
I shall issue a summons for Baron Astaroth, then, Rad sighed, pulling a sheet of blank parchment toward him.
Yes, a royal summons is just the thing to put the rogue in his place,
Anvarum said eagerly.
Put the royal guard on his trail.
No doubt he had visions of a grand chase through the countryside, a valiant fight with a rebellious wizard, and the ultimate triumph of seeing Astaroth in manacles before the throne.
There's no need to waste the sealing wax, your majesty, I said. Please bide.
I closed my eyes and had a quick conversation with Astaroth mind to mind. I quickly filled him in on what was happening and urged him to play his role. He is on his way, I said, a moment later, opening my eyes.
What? Tavard asked, confused.
He's here at the palace. Nay, he is elsewhere, but he is a high mage, one of the mightiest. He will arrive anon. In the meantime, I have heard rumour that there is word from Faris, I asked, hopefully.
There is, Rad agreed uncomfortably. It arrived this morning by messenger from the cursed. Why they didn't use the mirror is beyond me. But it came direct from a sailing ship bearing the flag of Faris. Old Faris, he added darkly, not the royal banner of the governor. It was the black diplomatic ensign bearing the three flames, the banner of the Doges.
May I ask what it said, my liege? I asked boldly. Tavard shot me a look. The fall of Faris was still a sore subject with him.
It is a matter for the ministers of state and war, but as you are in the royal court, it could concern you as well, he sighed.
He pulled a folded piece of parchment from under his empty plate, the seal of the Doge pressed deeply into the black sealing wax.
This is a letter from Pratt. He's been named the acting Doge of Faris in the name of his uncle by the Council of Faris. He claims the title as the last true mage lord of the Majocracy. He is supported, ironically enough, by the royal censorate of magic, who were founded to fight the Majocracy. More importantly, he enjoys the support of the Farisian navy, as well as a goodly portion of the Al-Shari navy, the rebel portion, the king added unnecessarily. Together they are declaring an interdiction zone around Faris and give fair warning that no ship should expect to cross the straits without being stopped, Rad said mournfully. You can expect the tolls they will charge to be high, if they allow them to pass at all, and with Pratt and the censors armed with Irionite, they can control the seas at will.
We will conquer them once again, father, Tavard assured, trying to sound confident.
Worry not, the Castel Shari will never submit to such brigands and pirates.
Oh, shut up, Tavard, Rad snapped as he seethed. This matter is your responsibility. You've undone what it took a generation and a fortune to take in the first place. If Pratt is to be believed, we're no better off than we were in my sire's day.
My king, I took the initiative and—
His son began to defend.
Spare me your rationalizations,
Rad said tiredly. I've heard them all too often. The province is lost, and I know not how it will be regained.
Even with magic, it would be a feat, your majesty, I agreed. How comes the new navy, my prince? I asked innocently.
Slowly,
Tavard admitted sullenly. I continue to raise funds for its equipage, but I am confident that we will sail soon enough to—
Enough of that talk,
Rad said sharply. We have more pressing matters at hand, apparently.
A dowry gone awry.
With Merwin menacing our frontiers in Wenshire and undead infecting the west and Gervani in the north, we have a misplaced bride to contend with. Gods, save the realm!
He nearly spat. Astaroth chose that moment to appear through the ways, directly on my waystone, as invited. He stumbled a bit as he arrived and nearly fell into Rad's lap, but he recovered with a display of grace a dancer would envy. It was the middle of the night, but Astaroth looked as fresh as a new-cut flower.
His long cloak of sable wool was trimmed with some dark fur and was clasped with a brilliant silver chain I was certain was enchanted to shine. His doublet was attractively cut and immaculately brushed, and he wore his baronial circlet, which was likewise enchanted to gleam.
"My apologies, Your Majesty," he said smoothly, before tugging at his heel. "I just got these shoes, and the heels are slightly off," he said, showing off his shiny leather shoes.
They were delicately tooled and dyed deep black, then polished to a high shine. Clearly, he was taking the opportunity to show off his taste in footwear to the leading gentleman of the kingdom. Astaroth's vanity knew no frontiers.
"Of course," Rad said with a sigh. "I remember you now. Warmage, the dapper one," he recalled.
"I'm honored to be remembered so by Your Majesty," Astaroth returned with a bow. "To what service can I be to the crown?"
"Astaroth, there has been an accusation of kidnapping laid upon you by this gentleman, Count Anvaram," Rad explained, gesturing at the Gilmoran. "My son brought it to my attention and insisted it be treated at once."
"Of course, sire," Astaroth agreed amiably. "As to the charge of kidnapping, I must demur. I merely sequestered my lady, as Gilmoran custom permits, until the dowry is completed and agreed upon," he explained. "I assure you that Lady Matherian is safe and secure, chaperoned by priestesses of Trigg, as custom also demands."
"Where?" demanded Anvaram. "We searched every estate in Lasara, and your other lands, and even the lands of your kin," he said angrily. "You say she is safe, but there is no abbey in Gilmora that admits her presence."
"I didn't say she was in an abbey, nor did I say she was in Gilmora," Astaroth informed them. "The customary law is clear in this case, but it does not specify just where her sequestration must be. Just that she be watched and guarded by nuns, preferably of the Trigine order, allowed to visit chapel at her demand, provided appropriate accommodations, adequate food worthy her station, at the groom's expense," he added. "I give you my word as a gentleman that all of the statutory obligations have been filled. I had my law brother check precedent most thoroughly."
"But where is she?" asked Tavard, pointedly. "If she is not in your castle, where have you hidden her?"
"Why, in a townhome I own, in Vanador," he said casually.
"Vanador!" scoffed Tavard. "I've never heard of the place."
He might have been lying, but it was clear that he wasn't particularly familiar with my seat.
"It is the capital of the Mage Law, my prince," I explained. "Then you are involved in this more than I suspected," Anvaram gasped, glaring at me and Astaroth in turn. "You stole her away by sorcery, and now she's imprisoned in a desolate, frozen wasteland by an even greater sorcerer."
"You hold the daughter of my vassal captive, sir," insisted the other count, Count Asmartan.
"Ah, that girl. Yes, she is a guest in Vanador, far to the north," I said, with a flamboyant flip of my hand. "She's comfortably lodged, fed as befits her station, and warded by nuns, in accordance with custom," I added.
"Did you not mention that you were in the middle of a war, Spellmonger?" Rad reminded me.
"Between wars, Majesty," I corrected politely. "I don't expect the next one to start for a few weeks."
"War!" squeaked Baron Maynard on cue. "With whom?"
"The very Gavanni who invaded Gilmora a few years ago," I answered.
"Fear not, your daughter is as safe as my own wife and daughter," I assured him calmly, "guarded behind an army of burly wilderlords, and warded by the finest mage lords in the land. Nothing could get to her," I said with a special emphasis, as I looked toward Anvaram. "Indeed, it would take courage beyond that of most knights to challenge such defences," I said haughtily.
"Yet we have no assurance but your word,"
her father moaned appropriately.
"My word is sufficient," I said sharply.
"We insist on proof of her well-being," Anvaram said, his lip curled into a sneer.
"If you think we'd accept the word of a scheming mage, for all we know she's been transformed into a sheep or something," he snorted.
"She's in as good health as ever, and looks nothing like a sheep," I replied patiently.
"If you want to lay eyes on her, then merely conclude the dowry, or you can visit her yourself. But I suggest you bring an army," I added disdainfully.
The mage law is replete with dangers. Don't think I would shy from such a challenge, Count, Anverem snapped. It is unseemly to negotiate under such circumstances. Why, he could be ravishing her every night, and we'd be none the wiser. And with magic involved, there is no telling what unseemly spells they've placed upon her. Majesty, I implore you to command her release at once.
Rad looked back and forth between us, his eyes shifting. I think he suspected that there was more at play here than a simple dowry. The intent expression on Tavard's face alone should have told him that. He cleared his throat and pronounced judgment. It seems to me that this is, indeed, a lawful sequestration of a bride, under Gilmoran custom, he decided. There was nothing untoward about the kidnapping, and Baron Asteral was within his rights to place the girl in a secure location. I take Count Minolin at his word that Vanador is such a place, and that this girl is being properly cared for and escorted.
But, Your Majesty, I...
Anverem began. If you object to this, then either conclude the dowry, or take action according to lawful custom, he reasoned. If you want to fetch this girl from Asteral, then send your men north and contest the matter properly. Though why you would undertake such a task for one girl is beyond me, he admitted, throwing his hand in the air. A matter of honour? It's foolishness. But if you want to contest Astaroth's possession of her, then proceed with the customary remedy. That is my ruling. So if you want her, you may come and get her, I agreed, but you'd best come prepared to fight. That is a fight you would lose, spellmonger, Anverem seethed. Why? Are you bringing someone other than Gilmoran knights? I mocked. You dare insult Gilmoran chivalry in front of the king? He asked, his mouth open. This isn't a tournament, Anverem, I said hotly. You would face real warriors, should you dare the mage law, I promised. The journey alone would kill you, I predicted. The knights of Gilmora are the finest in the kingdom, he boasted. If you ask minstrels, coin brothers, and brothel owners, I'd have no doubt they'd agree, I laughed. Dare speak ill of them again, and you will see how deadly they can be, Anverem agreed, his eyes staring daggers at me. I lead more than 1,000 knights myself. None would favour your words with anything but swordplay. Well, thank goodness for that, I quipped. If it was dice or horse racing, I might be concerned. Enough, Rad called sharply, though I could see he was entertained by the banter. I have made my decision. Anverem, either wait for negotiations to be complete or attack the mage law, he said, amused at the proposition. But I warn you, Count Minolin is a formidable foe, and the Wilderlands is an unforgiving battlefield. But do as you wish, he dismissed. I have made my decision. Thank you, Your Majesty, Asteron said with a low and respectful bow. And to you, gentlemen, it's not often I get to wear my evening garb in such esteemed company. Please let me know when you wish to renew negotiations. At your leisure. With that, he took his leave and left through the ways. Your friend is impertinent, Count Minolin, Tavard observed coldly. The Gavanni thought him so as well, I agreed, but he is in the right, and it is not in your power to challenge that, I sneered to Anverem. Now, I have more pressing matters to contend with. My wife is making cheese tomorrow, I said with all seriousness, and there is the matter of the Gavanni. Do I have your leave to depart, sire? You are dismissed, Minolin, agreed Rad apologetically. At least the news from Faris made this productive. Oh, it was far more productive than you might think, Majesty, I agreed, and with a mischievous glance at Tavard, I pushed myself through the ways. Chapter 6 Parley in a Ruined Tavern. I sing a song of good company, of nutty ale and fire. I sing of good tavern friends with whom you can conspire. I sing a song of tales of old, of stories and songs to amuse, or memories twixt old good friends, the hospitality you cannot refuse. Wilderland's Folk Song, from the collection of Janik the Riche. There wasn't much left of the inn or the village that surrounded it. That was depressing, but predictable. Penguin had been the target of opportunistic attack during the first invasion, sending its men west to answer the Duke's banner call to die at the fords of Bonsa, and then succumbing, almost defenceless, to the hordes that washed across the Wilderlands and down the roads from the Mindens. The goblins had left little standing. Penguin was a village of blackened poles and scorched foundations, overgrown gardens and abandoned fields. The inn where prosperous peasants and pack traders once spent their evenings was one of the better-preserved structures, believe it or not. The back wall still stood, although the roof was burnt to the scorched rafters and the thatch was a ruined mess. The stone foundation was undamaged but overgrown with vines and weeds. The doorway and the entire front of the building was just gone, somehow. Ironically, the only part of the inn that seemed entirely untouched was the comical-looking luck tree in front of it. I made a point of taking a piss there, in silent homage to the banished spirit of the place. Mavone and I arrived with a squadron of 20 ravens, who immediately took positions around the perimeter of the ruins. I'd included Tyndall simply because he'd known Kusi as well, and I thought his insights from the meeting might be valuable. I'd left the rest of my war council behind. If this was a trap, I wanted them to be in a position to rescue me, or avenge me. The renegade knight appeared an hour before midnight, riding a rangy-looking rouncy and carrying his lance point down. Two Gavanni accompanied him on fell hounds, both bearing spears with white cloths tied to the heads. That wasn't even remotely a Gavanni custom, but it was appreciated. It left little doubt that Kusi was here to parley. He stopped 50 feet from the inn and posted his guards around our steeds. They eyed our men, but made no move toward their weapons. The dogs sat at their master's command, their tongues lolling out like demonic puppies, and held a wary vigil. "I give you my word they will be left unmolested," Mavone pledged, as Kusi approached. "They know the risks of such a daring clandestine meeting," Kusi assured. "They volunteered. They felt it worth the risk that I speak to the spellmonger. Is he here?" "I am," I said as I emerged from the shadows. "You are safe for this parley. You have my word. Our men have surrounded the place and will allow no intrusions." "My thanks for your indulgence," Kusi said, giving me a slight, stiff bow. "I was unsure if you would consent to treat with me, but I figured that if there was any way to get a message to you, it would be through the agency of your chief spy." "Janik sends his regards, Sir Kusi," Mavone offered, "and his thanks for sparing his life. As a point of professional interest, what gave him away?" Kusi laughed, mirthlessly, which somehow made his ugly, scarred face even more gruesome in the shadows. "I've known what he's been up to in the penumbra for years," he confided. "It wasn't that hard to see. If you were human, and a Wilderlord, minstrels of his house have had their fingers in every pie in the north for 6 generations. "So why didn't you arrest him earlier?" I asked, confused. "Because he was one of the few conduits of authentic news I had from the east," Kusi explained, as he joined us in the ruined interior of the inn. "Real news, not the misheard rumours that persist amongst the Gavanni. He was the one who informed me of your elevation to Count, Master Menelin. My congratulations," he said sincerely. "I always knew you were ambitious, but that exceeds any expectation." "It's not as glamorous as it sounds," I dismissed, as I conjured a simple table and 4 chairs. Kusi's scarred face blinked, and he studied me carefully. "I see it is not just in temporal power that you have improved your position," the renegade knight said appreciatively at the result of the spell. "I've picked up a lot of tricks," I dismissed. "Some are useful." "And plenty of allies," Tyndall said, speaking to his former lord for the first time.
"Tyndall,"
Kusi said, an authentic smile spreading across his horrific face.
"Dear gods, is that you? You survive."
"I thrive," Tyndall corrected. "I am lord of all of Caliad now, a reward for faithful service to coronet and crown." His tone was wary and cautious, but not unfriendly. We both knew Kusi had never been an evil man. I suppose we were all concerned about how the old knight had changed under years of Sharul's domination. "Was there a particular matter you wished to discuss, Sire Kusi?" I asked. "Or did you just want a reunion?" The ruined knight nodded and sighed, no doubt remembering better days.
Of course. Time is short, and there is much to discuss. Shall we sit?
Once we'd taken seats under a dim mage light that was just enough illumination to let us see, but not so much it would attract attention, Kusi cleared his throat and began.
As you know, Korbal the demon god, a figure I always thought was base folklore, purely mythological, betrayed and overthrew the old god at Ulam Sahiri,
he began. Yes, we were right there when it happened, acknowledged Tyndall, which produced an appreciative expression from Kusi. Sire Kay nearly shattered old Sharul.
Were you really? Then you know beyond doubt. When his treachery was revealed and Sharul contained, it also severed the powerful bond the old god had over my mind. For the first time in years, I was free of the constant presence in my head, the relentless oversight of my every thought, the answering echo to my darkest fears, my torment ended, only to confront me with the horrors I had inflicted in its name, he said, his voice hoarse and darkly foreboding.
Yet you continued to serve, Tyndall said accusingly.
What else could I do?
Kusi asked, his eyes filled with pathos.
I had betrayed my own kind, and in the process was betrayed in turn. I will never be welcome again among the Humani. My home has been transformed into a hell. Yet I feel obliged to atone for my role, whether it was compelled or not. When my mind was freed, he continued, fighting past the pain of the memory, I found myself in charge of the security of guns. A respectable and necessary position, if a demotion from the rank I once had in Sharul's armies. I had a corps of those Gavani who had been loyal to me from the beginning, and I had a relationship with Ashakal, the exiled goblin king. The Enshadowed were everywhere, deposing their rivals with squadrons of Draugan and base sorcery. Then the Nemovorti arrived in force. That placed me in a position with few allies and a great deal of potential enemies.
I feel such sympathy for you, Tyndall said sarcastically.
The fact that I survived at all should count toward your enmity to me, my lord,
Kusi said.
No punishment you could devise could improve upon the horror I feel walking through the ruins of my lands, or the knowledge that I was, in part, responsible for it.
The knight said it so sincerely that it stayed Tyndall's tongue of further jibes.
The rule of the Enshadowed and the accursed Nemovorti has driven away those Gavani who saw Korbal's betrayal as too much to bear. King Ashakal and many of his court fled in the middle of the day, along with their loyal troops, assisted by most of the renegade knights of the Penumbra, Kusi continued steadily. They were fleeing before the crest of the wave. The next day, the Enshadowed brought hundreds of Enshadowed Alka Alon, transformed by sorcery for war, and hundreds of Alon Dradrian to the Umbralands. They've taken over Bothal Vale and the use of the Malapar, he informed us.
Of all of this we were aware, I pointed out.
Thanks to your spy, Janik, Kusi nodded, who also brought word of your victory over Gajakatar a few weeks ago. From what I understand of the battle, the desertion of troops loyal to Ashakal was telling in the outcome. I can only surmise that you and Ashakal reached some agreement, he proposed.
I recognized a probe when I saw it. Our purposes were not at odds, I conceded. We have a mutual foe. And a treaty, I reminded him with a smirk. That inspired a hideous grin.
Ah, yes, our treaty. I recalled negotiating it with the dashing young Prince Tavard and that minister, Moran.
Kusi nodded.
Under the circumstances, I would not think that the Duke would hold to it.
The King does, as does the Count of the Mage Law, I agreed. It suited our purpose to respect it at this time. But we understand its worth, I added.
You share a foe with King Ashakal, it would seem, Kusi said sagely. I may have been coerced into my service with the old god, but I grew to respect certain aspects of the Gavani. Many are as valiant and courageous as any knight. Many saw the betrayal of the old god as reason to rebel. The proud among them recall the tales of their ancestors' centuries of service before their rebellion. They do not wish to return to the service of the Elka alone, regardless of their politics. Ashakarl himself is rather enlightened, Kusi continued. Some of his court priests are very conservative, however, but neither party favors obeying the commands of the Nemavorti. Since they took over governance of the Umbralands, things have gotten even more dire. The Enshadowed strut arrogantly among the Gavanni and demand obedience as a matter of course. Decisions are made without regard to the consequences. Morale is low. The Gavanni sought to conquer the lands of their ancestors and make them their own again. The Nemavorti only desire to use them to further their greater purpose. Again, we hear no fresh news here, Mavone prompted impatiently. What you may not know is that the three Nemavorti, who command over Boval Vale, now are preparing an expedition of sorts. Some of the elite amongst the Enshadowed have been gathered and are training themselves for a journey into the icy wastes in the north. To what purpose? I asked, suddenly alert. I had business in the north myself. To gain the alliance of some dark force that lurks there, supplied Kusi. Some presence that has been hiding there for thousands of years. Korbal's court is excited about it. It is hoped that the alliance will supply the power that Korbal needs to challenge the remaining Elka Alon fortresses.
He has dragons, goblins, armies, and a Malapor, Tyndall snorted. He's taken one city and ruined countless refuges. Has he not a sufficiency of force?
Apparently not, Kusi said. Korbal did not expect that his foes would raise allies of their own among the Humani and interpose them between our forces, Kusi pointed out. Nor did any foresee that you would be so effective in that defense. No one expected you to slay three dragons, and no one expected you to challenge Korbal in Olum Saheri and bind him to his putrescent form, he concluded, wrinkling his ruined nose. Though carefully plotted for centuries, the Enshadowed did not count on facing the spellmonger and his wizards. You were not foreseen. You have proven more of a threat than anticipated. Without more powerful allies, Korbal fears his failure.
Yes, that's essentially the plan, Tyndall agreed dryly.
You speak of Korbal, but you said you bear a message, Mavone asked.
He was more anxious than I was, which was telling.
King Ashakarl is in a precarious state in his exile, Kusi agreed. Those flinty hills provide distance and cover, but ultimately they are a poor defense against the legions of the Necromancer. The Goblin King has many enemies and few allies. He is remote from his rivals, but not beyond their reach. His supporters are fragmented and disunified, the Scarred Knight said in a calm, raspy voice. He balances the traditional culture of the Gavanni tribes with the more civilized Gavanni from Gantz. What was once Gantz, he corrected. Those who have adopted human custom and styles and made themselves friendly to the renegade lords who count Ashakarl their liege. The most zealous Ur-Gulnosti priests have retreated with King Ashakarl, but bereft of Sharul's overlordship and arcane might, they themselves are splitting into factions. Some wish to attack the Nemavorti with their entire might to recover their Dark Lord. Some wish to guard their ancient homelands and be at peace.
Either course seems incredibly unlikely to succeed, Mavone pointed out.
A popular opinion at Ashakarl's court,
Kusi agreed sadly.
Peace seems a distant, hollow promise to most Gavanni, those not indoctrinated into the legions from birth, who know life only as a pursuit of obedience, brutality, devotion, and war. The old tribesmen still raise proper families, he said admiringly. They have some sense of decency.
Except for eating human flesh, I observed.
That was an affectation enforced by the Ur-Gulnosti as a ritual to inspire vengeance.
And feed the troops, he admitted.
The tribal mountain folk were never in favor of that. They tend to find the practice distasteful. Indeed, it is spoken against aggressively by some.
Well, that's hopeful, Tyndall agreed. We don't eat them.
That, too,
has been noted. Kusi sighed. The upshot of my embassy, Minalan, is that King Ashakal sorely needs friends, or at least fewer enemies. Some actively counsel for him to sue for peace with you, considering your newly raised estate. They consider Korbal's dominion a horrible betrayal and a return to a dark, dark past.
As opposed to our dark, dark present, I nodded, my eyes narrowing. You say that some counsel in favor of this cease in hostilities, as unlikely as it sounds. What thinks His Majesty? I asked, genuinely curious. I'd seen the Gervan at the royal court once, but had never spoken at length to him. I'm guessing it would have been awkward.
Ashakal refuses to make his mind known to his court, lest he unbalance the lot and invite disaster,
Kusi reported.
He contends with crisis daily and is able to postpone discussion of strategy in open court, but I suspect he would welcome one less enemy at his door.
I'm far from his door, I countered, and in truth, there is little I can do against him at the moment. I have another Nemovort to challenge, the second in months. But from that vantage, I can see one less enemy, myself, if I just wait for Korbal to contend with Ashakal. I have no personal animosity toward the Gervan, but he represents a rival power. If I wait long enough, he'll be gone.
But he also ceases to be an enemy if he is an ally, countered Kusi, or at least had a quiet understanding.
You propose a secret alliance? Asked Mavone, troubled. I don't think Minalan's vassals, nor his lieges, would accept the truth of that.
Politics, he added. Having a gentleman's understanding is one thing. This would be a step beyond.
Kusi nodded.
Nor would Ashakal's vassals, legions, and tribal chieftains approve of such a thing.
Politics, he agreed with a grunt, tossing his scarred hand into the air.
Yet that does not dismiss the potential benefits of such an arrangement. Even I can see that. I shall be blunt, my lords. There could well be utility in such an awkward alliance for both the King of the Gavani and the Count Palatine of the Mage Law.
We chewed on that idea for a moment, and I had to admit to myself that it had some merit. The Goblin King was an existential threat to all humanity, in theory. But, bereft of Shuru's malignant influence, Ashakal was no direct threat to me, compared to Shakathet's legions, or the other Nemovorti, or Korbal. Indeed, I had more to fear from the Gilmoran chivalry I was regularly pissing off than I did Ashakal's meagre forces. But he had intimate knowledge of Korbal's armies, and perhaps other good intelligence we could use, I reasoned. Getting Ashakal to stand down from attacking me and focus on attacking Korbal was just good strategy. From our perspective, Ashakal was behind enemy lines and had access to his vulnerable supply routes. Even a passive alliance, if properly managed, could produce productive results in our struggle against Korbal. I could not, in good conscience, ignore this overture. Give me a moment of thought alone, please, I requested finally with a deep sigh. I need to contemplate this before I answer. That took Mavone and Tyndall by surprise, and I could see why. Usually I'm pretty decisive about such things, but I needed to give this proposal some careful thought before I committed to anything. I needed counsel. I needed perspective. Sometimes, I'd learned, a wizard needs a moment to stick a pipe in his mouth and just think. I wandered away from the ruined tavern and sought a quiet grove of cedars nearby, while I dug in my pouch for my pipe. Once I was out of sight and earshot of my men and Kusi, and the megalith had assured me that no one was scrying, I packed my pipe and lit it with a cantrip.
Now would be an excellent time, O flame of life, I mumbled sarcastically around the stem as I coaxed the coal in the bowl to life.
Don't make me say the childhood prayer, I added.
It makes me feel silly.
You really are learning wisdom,
a mildly sarcastic woman's voice said from behind me.
I don't have a lot of time, Brigger, I said, turning to face my patroness. This seems an opportunity out of nowhere, or a cunningly laid trap. Some divine perspective would be really helpful about now.
Luckily, there are enough of my worshippers still in those lands to give me some,
she nodded, her scarlet tresses seeming to move like flames when she did. "The offer is legitimate, if uncertain, Minilin. From what I can tell, Ashakar does want to cease fighting with the humans. Korbal is a greater threat to his rule than you are. The renegades and exiles in his court are tired of war and wary of the purposes to which they would be put under Nemavorti rule. Already, the legions you spared at Spellgarden are arriving at his capital, speaking of the spellmonger's mercy and his terrible, terrible vengeance against Gajakatar."
"I hate to take credit for that," I objected. "That was mostly Terlaman's doing, and Sandoval's."
"Trust me, they are both well known in the Gavanni ranks," Brigger agreed, "but as the spellmonger's men."
"So, should I take this secret alliance or reject it?" I asked, perhaps a bit of a whine in my voice. It was the middle of the night, and I was standing in a cold cedar grove. I was tired. I just wanted her to tell me what to do.
"You should understand it before you do either,"
Rigger suggested.
"Ashakar is indeed in a precarious position. He represents the last major power center of true Gavanni nationalism in the Wilderlands. All of the other rebels to Korbal's rule have fallen or consolidated under Ashakar's banner. The tribal chieftains are content that they have returned to their ancestral hills and see their quest fulfilled. They never desired the war of genocide the Black Skulls preached. For their part, the Black Skulls are demoralized and divided. Without Shirul uniting them and giving them purpose, they're acting like a bunch of sulky backwoods spellmongers without a client. Then you have the human renegades," she continued, lecturing. "The goddess started pacing, leaving steaming footprints in the ground behind her. For the most part, they were forced to swear loyalty to Ashakar under duress, but they've stayed true to that oath, bound by circumstance or their own feelings of honour. In return, they've supported him against the other forces in his court. They've also managed to run the remaining functional estates far more efficiently and productively than the settlements the Gavanni have ruled. That makes them economically valuable," she added. "So, what do I do?" I repeated, getting a little exasperated. "What is it you wizards usually do?" she asked, snorting. "Be subtle. Suggest a few simple experiments, under the cloak, if you will, and then evaluate them. If they spark, feed the flame," she shrugged. "There are worse outcomes than having an independent Gavanni state on your frontiers."
"Currently, Korbal's minions lie between us," I pointed out.
"Not as much. After Gajakatar's defeat," she countered. "Indeed, some of the tribal chieftains are already considering expanding their territories and raiding what's left of his lands. There isn't much in the way of organized resistance there," she pointed out.
"But then there is the Nemavort, Shakathet," I pointed out.
"Yes, there is Shakathet," she frowned. "He builds an army twice the size of Gajakatar's. And he isn't an idiot, alas. He will strike at you soon, and not at Spellgate," she added.
"Is that prophecy?" I asked. I had to. I hated prophecy.
"That's an astute observation," she countered. "All indications point to him attacking across the big rivers and trying to get behind Spellgate. Probably from the south," she added, after a moment's divine contemplation. "That's about all I can give you right now."
"That's helpful," I decided. "It confirms some of what we've discovered about his plans. We focused most of our defences in the northeast over the winter. I'm certain our southern flank appears vulnerable."
"Your southern flank is vulnerable. Even I can see that," she agreed.
"A feint at either Verone or Megalin is probable," she continued. "But there is no doubt that Shakathet will invade Vanador. For it is on the road to a jewel he covets even more.
Anus Yatharel."
"Ashakar isn't going to be able to help with that," I sighed.
"Not directly. But Shakathet is not the only Nemavort you face,"
she reminded me unnecessarily.
"In general, I tend to favour the possibility of an alliance. Driving the Gavanni out of the hills would be exceedingly difficult, even without the enshadowed and undead to contend with. That may be a portion of the Wilderlands that may have to be permanently ceded to Ashakar in such a case.
That's going to make some Will the Lords very unhappy, I pointed out.
What? Will the Lords, Min? She asked skeptically.
Most of the native Narasi cavalry in that region perished early in the war, defending their homes from the surprise invasion at the fords of Bonsa. What few of their heirs survived are lucky to be alive. They're in the Wildalore or in Varone, or already under your protection, she explained. They aren't in any positions to make demands of you. You have sovereignty over that region, according to Anguin. It's your decision.
That's it, I said, waving my pipe stem in annoyance. Kick the problem downstairs. But if you can assure me that Ash-Shakal is sincere...
As much as I can,
she agreed, with a fiery shrug. Don't ask me how you give a fiery shrug. She managed.
That's no guarantee that you won't get betrayed, or he doesn't get defeated or overthrown, or any number of catastrophic things. But he is sincere. If you accept, he plans on proceeding in good faith, I think.
You think?
I asked skeptically. This is a decision that could compromise my entire realm. It's the best I have to offer, she said, throwing up her hands. Nothing is certain, Min. Not even me.
I sighed. Thank you. And I'm sorry.
Don't be, she nodded. I actually understand. It's a difficult decision. He's an enemy. Even if you ally with him, he'll never be a friend.
But I could use a few thousand less goblins who want to slit my throat, I mumbled. I should use Gurkarl as an ambassador.
Emissary, she corrected. His diplomatic standing is dodgy in Ashakar's court.